Top of the afternoon to you. You're welcome to lunchtime. Larry Tompkins is his name, the Cork manager who escaped the wrath of the GAA last week after his performance at the Munster final, is, quote, a man understood by the people of the Lee. So says the Irish Examiner's front page today. We got Christina Noble joining us this afternoon. In our Rolling Back the Years segment today, we've had a request from Joe Moriarty in County Roscommon for a replay of the interview we recorded in 1995 with Sir Patrick Mayhew in his Sydney hotel room. At the time, you'll recall, Sir Patrick and Albert Reynolds were busily working toward what was to become the Good Friday Agreement, which was threatened then, much as it is today, by the issue of disarmament. It was also a time when Sinn Féin's Gerry Adams was courting the governments of the world for support and attempting to gain a visa to visit Australia. Whilst the visa was eventually granted, some suggested that this was not what Sir Patrick would have wished for. I began by asking him, why have you come to Australia?
I'm here, first of all, to say that Northern Ireland is a very good place to invest. 13 or 14 months, something that passes for peace. It means that...
Sorry, something that passes for peace.
Yes, passes for peace. It's not real peace. It's not. And they're not being bombed, and their jobs are not being destroyed by huge losses to business property.
Is this a situation that's going to last?
That's a good question to ask those people who've used the violence and how we've got to this position and what the future may hold.
And the answer to the aforementioned question, where are we and how did we get here?
We're a bit of an impasse at the moment, but we're miles better off. They're determined that they're not going to be dragged back into it.
The general consensus in Ireland, in the north of Ireland then at the moment, is that there is peace or a qualified peace?
A qualified peace, because punishment beatings, so-called, are going on more than there were before the ceasefires.
And these are punishments for what sort of crime?
Punishments for being unpopular with the paramilitaries at each end.
What would make you unpopular with the paramilitaries? What sort of...
If you happen to behave tiresomely, for example, you're a youngster and you've gone in for joyriding, taking cars and being a joyrider. Compatible, of course, with a real established peace, so that has to be borne in mind.
There is a view amongst some cynical Southern Irish people that the reason that the IRA and such organisations involve themselves in punishment beatings, particularly in the area of people they deem involved in the drug market, is because they're trying to knock off the competition. Do you think there's any truth to that sort of cynicism?
Well, there's no doubt about it that a certain amount of speaking here of the unionists who represent most people in Northern Ireland.
From a negotiating perspective, though, strictly analysing the thing as though it were a business, are you not sort of taking some of the negotiating clout away from some of the parties involved in the negotiation by insisting on total disarmament before negotiations can even effectively begin?
Well, by that very question, you show that you think that the clout consists of, exactly because they fear that they won't sit down at the table.
Is it possible that the lack of getting this thing to a head now is going to bring us back into what's been going on for the last 25 years?
Well, all things are possible, but whether it is probable is a question to put to those who've used violence in the past. Obviously, the Irish government would like to see a united Ireland. Nothing wrong in that, of course not. Perfectly proper ambition to have. Once that's the case, what conceivable excuse can there be for going back to violence?
I know that I speak on behalf of 99% of the people in Ireland when I wish you the very best of luck with resolving these things. In terms of the man behind the job, as it were, though, how do you personally cope with what must be one of the most strenuous jobs in the world?
Well, it's one of the most interesting jobs. I don't kid myself that I'm going to find the answer to this, but I do think that I and my colleagues can help the people of Northern Ireland, the people of Ireland North and South, to find this solution. As I said, you can't impose it, but you can help people, I think, to find it for themselves. Mm.
And the timing of the trip to Australia, because there were rumours recently that there were people here trying to assess whether or not Gerry Adams would get a favourable hearing from the Australians. It's not anything to do with that you came out?
Well, whether Mr Adams comes here to Australia is entirely a matter for the Australian government. I very much hope that if he does come here, he will be asked some pretty important questions.
What's the question you'd like to ask most?
Well, I think I've suggested one or two of them. How in a democracy can you possibly justify?
In terms of the Australian visit, I know that your good wife is here as well, and doing you good public relations work, I believe. She's involved herself in lots of charity work and that sort of thing as well.
Well, it's very much more, I think, than that. I mean, for 3.5 years now, or the last 3 years anyway, she has been engaged full-time and voluntarily in...
Not to another man.
We didn't in the end get engaged. We were engaged and then break it off. And then we never got engaged again. We just got married.
Oh, good for you.
Well, a long time ago now. I mean, her sort of standing starts from the fact that she's the Secretary of State's wife. I think and believe it's been helpful. But she's the best person to talk about these things, not me.
I trust that you enjoyed your stay in Australia. You're off to New Zealand, is that right?
Very much. I always love coming to Australia. It's the third time I've been here. My stepmother is a New South Wales Sydneyite.
Oh, really?
And,
yeah. Oh, there you go.
And I've been able to see her, and so that's been great. And I'm now off to New Zealand.
Well, I hope the weather will be a little more graceful.
Well, you need this here. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this sort of weather if you come from Northern Ireland.
Yes, we were pointing the finger at you, actually, saying, tell them to bring the weather home with them.
I never take credit for good weather, just for that reason.
A pleasure to meet you, Sir Patrick Mayhew. Thanks very much indeed.
Enjoyed it very much. Thanks a lot.
Operator, number please. It's been so many years, and I remember quiet evenings trembling close to you.
The growling Corkonian there, that's Freddie White. I must say, interesting now to listen to the interview with Sir Patrick Mayhew, given the events of the past few weeks. At a dinner on Friday evening last, another night, Sir Tony O'Reilly declared that Trimble has fallen on his sword. Let me know what you think of that comment, 1-800-000-000. And I suppose that as an ex-Lion, it was a bad weekend all round for Sir O'Reilly, with his old team suffering defeat at the hands of the Australians on Saturday morning Irish time for the first time in over 100 years. Whilst Lady O'Reilly's horse, Rebelline, put in a somewhat disappointing performance at the Curragh in the Kildangan Stud Irish Oaks, taken this year by Ed Dunlop's Leilani, who won by a neck from stable companion and another Dunlop horse, Mott Just. Next up this morning, we're joined in the studio by Christina Noble, whose book Bridge Across My Other Sorrows goes on sale this week. That's after music from that old croner. Here is Cheryl.
I used to ride with a vending machine. Whatever really happened here? Every day is a winding road.
And every day certainly has been a winding road for our studio guest this morning, a woman who came up on the wrong side of the dark line, perhaps as a result of which she has dedicated her life to helping underprivileged children, most notably the street children of Vietnam. Quote, Christina Noble's account of her childhood is shattering and inspiring, a record of grief and courage that would wring a tear from a stone. The author's integrity burns white hot on the page. No one could invent these details. Few could survive them. Such are the sleeve notes from Dervla Murphy on Christina Noble's new book, Bridge Across My Other Sorrows, out later this week. And I'm delighted to welcome Christina to the studio this morning. Christina, why did a busy woman like you write this book?
Well, the book is an autobiography on my life. And the reason the book came around really was because I work with children in Vietnam. I tried to get interest in Vietnam. Nobody wanted to know. So I asked the newspapers to do a story.
Interest in what, Christina?
Interested in help, giving me money so I could go back and I could help the children.
Right. What was wrong with all the children that they were? This was as a result of trade embargoes, and that there was sorry state of affairs.
Well, in Vietnam at that time, I mean, there was famine. My father was an alcoholic, and it wasn't a bad guy, but he abandoned us because of his alcoholism, and so the family was split up.
Is that the way you perceive? I mean, you can look back on it now and say he wasn't a bad bloke; it was just the alcohol.
Well, I can say that I think because I believed in those people. I really believed.
You speak as one who sounds somewhat disillusioned.
Very disillusioned. Now I'm 50 years old. I can be a bit more objective than I used to be about it. I do realise that not all nuns and priests are bad. However, I can only speak on my experiences.
Just most of them.
Well, my experiences were certainly not good. I lived in on the streets. I lived in the Phoenix Park.
And would they not have looked after you in that scenario and therefore been...
Well, the way that, yes, they would look after you, but the way to look after you was to put you into an institution, into an industrial school, and beat the living daylights out of you.
Yeah, you can say shite because nobody understands what that means here.
Yeah, well, they beat the shit out of you.
And now you're after breaking the... Oh, for God.
It was like her death itself was quite horrific.
Mm. And so what happened to your mother then? Is that something you want to talk about?
I don't think it's necessary now to talk about. I think the nuns and priests. I mean, if you're living in a hovel, I'd been sexually abused by a relative as well, and physically, most of us were physically abused anyway. I don't want to name the priest now, even though he's dead. But she said, I was in a pretty bad way. I was really in a bad way. And
what was wrong
with
you?
Well, it was like, come back tomorrow. Well, I'd been very badly abused, you know.
Mm. Over a period of time?
Over a period of time, yeah. And it happened again even later when I was 16, having been raped by four men in Dublin. And, I mean, you're Irish, so if you go back to 40s and 50s, I know you're not that old, but as an Irishman, you have some idea of the sort of history, and sometimes they say hide under the bed until the old one is asleep, you know. Mm. But as soon as the mother found out, it was like, get her out of here.
As though there was some sort of stigma attached.
Girls are trouble. Well, what they used to say is...
Or the fact that you were homeless is what they saw as being the problem.
Two things. One, well, no, there was the fact that I didn't have a mother. I didn't have a father. My father was a drunk. The only time a priest really took an interest in me was outside a pub in Rialto, where I was looking for my father, and he offered me a gin and tonic outside the door, and I was only a little one. And, I mean, I knew the smell, you know. And at that time, to me, like, it was strange.
Am I reading this correctly now? What sort of interest did this priest take?
Well, his interest, you know... If I'd have drank the gin and tonic, and in a country so small, in an island that we all kind of knew each other,
an island of saints and scholars,
and sinners, the trees, the birds. Mostly, I ate from the trees anyway. Leaves, I used to call them like cheese, you know, bacon and egg.
You ate leaves from trees.
Yeah, I used to call them rashers and eggs, and I had a lot of pride and a lot of dignity, so I didn't do it when anyone was watching.
Wait till they were gone and then Scarborough.
Wait till they were gone, yeah, and even where the rail is and down underneath in the bushes.
When you say where you lived, this was a part of the park, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's the Molyneux. It's still there.
How did you survive? I mean, Ireland is not renowned for its tropical temperatures.
No. I had to cover myself with paper and clay, so in a way it was a kind of grave. And I live like a criminal. I hid like one. I was terrified of being a human being. Hated it. Hated being a human being. I hated it. And hid into church sometimes, you know, you go into... Mainly when I was very hungry, I went into the church. If it was lashing out the heavens, I'd go into John's Lane Church or somewhere like that. And it was all the candles were always burning, you know. And as the grease would fall, it was soft, you see. So you catch the grease and I used to eat it. And I pretend that I was really eating food. I swallowed it, and it gets hard real fast, you know. Finally, I was raped in Ireland, and again ended up sleeping in the park. Because I was the orphan, I had to go in like their furnace. And if that place wasn't roasting hot, I got a belt in.
And was it some kind of like Magdalen laundry?
A bit like that. We used to have to do all the town laundry. You know, you had to be up at four and then you'd bring
Was it not like heaven by comparison with sort of trying to survive in the Phoenix Park?
No, it was much better to survive in the Phoenix Park. I know people can't understand the side of the road, and if not, you'll end up in pagan England and all that kind of stuff. So.
And they probably thought that they were doing you a favour, did they? I mean, with retrospect, do you think that they that these people were genuinely sort of escaping society because they realised they had masochistic or sadomasochistic tendencies, or because they genuinely believed they were doing the right thing and this was the way they should do it?
I think at that time I had a dream. It sounds corny. It sounds, I like to say, I went to Vietnam on a holiday and I stayed. It would be easier, but nevertheless.
And this was leaving the three kids that you had had at this stage?
No, no, no. This was in 1971. I did nothing. Like Peugeot. Like
so these are
computers.
Kids now that you've looked after little girls, from Vietnam.
Yeah. Girls learning to be designers. I mean, I don't mean learning to stitch. Suicide amongst young people, amongst the children and the youth, is on a scale that's unimaginable.
And is this something then that the Christina Nopel aforementioned foundation seeks in sort of across the world way to combat, or?
Yes.
We're starting in Vietnam. Yes.
Our foundation is fighting for the rights of all children. You name it, you know, everything is cool because they don't care. They don't care. They say, why should we care?
But on the one hand, you're saying that, you know, we're all becoming terribly mechanical and all the rest. Grab your coffee there before it goes freezing cold on you as well. We're all becoming too mechanical. And then on the other hand, you're sort of saying that, you know, we've got these human instincts causing problems within us because we can't fulfill the need for things like love. Is there not a sort of a contradiction there somewhere along the line? We've got to move with the times and maybe we've got to make ourselves a little bit less innate.
I totally disagree with you. If you see where I see, what has that been mechanical? You've got to be mechanical to do that, haven't you? How can you do
sick.
That?
You've got to be sick to do
that. Well, that's
like
what
that,
I mean, mechanical. You understand what I'm saying?
But I differentiate between mentally ill people and...
No, we cannot go using the same bloody excuses all the time. Mental illness, you know? Do me a favour. If I have to shut up because I'm afraid, then I've got to just join the rest of the clan.
A noble cause, an appropriate surname. Christina Nopel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Grafton Street, I'm a stranger.
Frances Black there, rumoured to again be a Gubberlesh Nancy Griffith. Thank you for your company today. On tomorrow's show, we're joined by Dennis O'Brien live from Portugal on his hopes for keeping Irish telephone companies Irish. So that promises to be an interesting chat. Also, our weekly look at Women in the Limelight, a section for which we have an unending list of contenders. And of course, the best of music. Till then, this is Ken Joyce saying bye for now.